Hello, med students. My name is Phil Leger, and thank you for downloading this episode of the EM Clerkship Podcast. Like we said in the intro episode last week, this is an EM bolus episode, so if you need to be anywhere in the next 7 to 8 minutes, you might want to wait to listen to this on the ride home, or on lunch, or, you know, whatever. Today, we are really excited to open our EM bolus series with an interview with Chip Lang from the Total EM Podcast. We received a lot of feedback from PAs and nurse practitioners and thought it would be a great way to start off the series. Chip is an emergency medicine physician assistant working in a community hospital in rural Missouri. He is also an EMT and volunteer firefighter, and if that wasn't enough, he is the host of the Total EM Podcast and just an all-around nice guy. He has international experience in critical care and emergency medicine. At his main shop, he acts as preceptor to both medical students and PA students. His special interests include bedside ultrasound, critical care management, and medical education. So with that, we hope you enjoy the show.
So can you hear me okay at this point?
Yeah, you know what? I think that's pretty standard audio quality there on a telephone call. No problem.
Okay, I just want to make sure, because like I said, we can always switch to another option if we need to.
No, that sounds good. That sounds good. So thanks for joining us, or thanks for joining me on the show. I really appreciate it. Our inaugural interview, which is great. And just can you tell us a little bit about who you are, and your name, and who you are, and where you are in the United States, and that kind of thing?
Sure. Well, first off, thanks, Phil, for letting me come on to the podcast and talk a little bit. So my name is Chip Lang. I'm a physician assistant practicing primarily in rural Missouri. Right where I live at is in the south central part of the state. It is not uncommon for us that our hospitals are at least an hour apart, usually tertiary care centers even further apart. At my main shop that I'm at currently, it is about 2 hours in any direction to a true tertiary center. And then a place I was at before that, it was even further away. So we're very used to practicing in a semi-rural kind of state where we have few, if any, specialists depending on the hospital. And so really, a lot of our care, we have to start managing patients early, and then we can try and get them to the level of getting them appropriate for a transfer safely. So a lot of the interesting things about the podcast that exists beside mine, like, for example, MCRIT or ERCAST, you know, they talk about the specialists that they have in-house. Most of the specialists they talk about, I don't have, and nor are they anywhere close to me. So I have to really be able to provide a broad spectrum of care, realizing that there's really no backup in sight.
So is your emergency department facing some of the same overcrowding and overuse by frequent flyer type patients that urban EDs constantly complain of, or is it a different story totally?
It is very much the same, and that's been true for the smaller places and the bigger places I've worked at. I mean, it's across the board an issue. Now, in theory, we have some walk-in clinics, and we have what's called an urgent care. A lot of people refer to it as an urgent care, but it's really a walk-in clinic. They don't deal with a lot of sicker patients that usually an urgent care would take versus sending to an ED. And with that size, it tends to save us some of those lower priority patients, but it's not so much like at the urban ED I work with. We hardly see those patients because they are going to their local cheaper resources, or they have a better outlet, you know, better PCP follow-up. We don't really have a good base. A lot of our people either have no insurance or underinsured, or they have Medicaid, Medicare, and they may just say, hey, it's just as easy for me to go to the ED versus my PCP, so I'm just going to come there. So we definitely had that issue. In the smaller places, like the last shop I was at, they were just starting kind of a local walk-in clinic, and that helped to some degree, but it still led to a lot of unnecessary visits to the ED just because, oh, I have something I can't get in with my doctor today. I don't want to wait. I just want to have the convenience of going there. So I think a big part of it is having good walk-in and urgent care support. I really think that makes a big difference.
So let's back up just for a minute here. I want to sort of let you have an opportunity to tell us about your experience and places you've trained, because you have some international experience as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is kind of a weird ordeal. So I started out in fire EMS, and I still do a little bit of both. In fact, we have a big training I'm trying to get ready for on the firefighting side tomorrow, and so because I'm their training officer. But one of the big things that I got to do early on in my career was actually get to go to London to King's College Hospital. And it is a very big trauma center, and they actually do a bunch of other things too. But they have what's called, over there they call it, instead of the ER, the ED, they call it the A&E for accident and emergency. And they split up their department in basically three types of patient settings. There's minors, which is like your fast track side. Then there's majors, that'd be like your STEMI or stroke. There's also other ones such as trauma and resuscitation. And that's where I spent most of my time, was on the trauma and resuscitation side of it. And that is very intense. Every day I was there, we got to see at least one stabbing. We got to see one suicide attempt of any variety. It seems like a preference around there was just jump in front of a train or jump off a bridge or something like that. I saw one stroke and I saw one STEMI pretty much every single day without fail. And that led to a lot of experience very quickly. Whereas the departments I work at now, you know, we're lucky if we see one of those, you know, every week or month or so, depending on the condition. You know, some of the strokes, I mean, are more common, but you know, like I said, stabbings or shootings or any of those types of things, we just don't see as much given our population or location. But that really helped me get a lot of experience very quickly. I got to see some thoracotomies and some cricothyrotomies and other techniques as well that just, you know, those are the things that are rare for most people to ever do once. And I get to see several of those on that place at that rotation. So I also have worked in up in Ohio and Michigan area, or I should say I was on rotations up in Ohio and Michigan because that was my original school. I went to University of Toledo's PA program. Very great school. Really highly recommend it. Not that I'm at all biased, but it is a very well-done program. And I got to see a lot of things in the Ohio and Michigan area, which isn't really that different from Missouri in some ways, except for everywhere I was at, you know, we're pretty close to a tertiary care center, or I was at a tertiary care center. You get to see a lot of sicker patients more frequently.
Yeah, so your educational background, your experiences have kind of come maybe a little bit full circle, and you yourself are an educator now.
Yeah, so daily for me, I frequently have students, whether they're med students, PA students, sometimes nursing or paramedic students. Really doesn't matter, but usually have some form of a student with me almost every single month, almost every single shift. And I really enjoy that because every student comes with their own background and their own experiences. And I always make sure to ask them, like, hey, what do you want to see or what do you want to learn? Because I can't always guarantee that I'm going to have them get to see everything because, like I said, we just don't have the patient population, it seems like, when you're in that kind of a setting. But we'll at least talk about how to manage all those patients. And so those are some of the big things I like to cover, especially if this is student's only chance to learn emergency medicine. And I really want to get as much of that as possible, all the critical care type things and some of the things that are just unique to the ED that aren't going to be seen in, say, internal medicine or primary care. So I really spend a lot of time on those issues. And it's enough so that I decided to go ahead and start my own podcast called Total EM just to kind of help incorporate and add more to that knowledge base because I want to be able to tell students, hey, go to this podcast and you can listen to this, especially for issues that aren't covered on other great podcasts such as InCrit.
Yeah, it should be mentioned that Chip and I, and Zach Olson for that matter, are big fans of Scott Weingart and the EM Crit podcast. And since we're plugging away here, I'm going to drop a plug for Min Lekong and the Farm podcast, PHARM podcast, pre-hospital and retrieval medicine. He's a flight doc out of Australia. Great stuff. And you've had him on your podcast, right?
Right. He was actually my first person to interview And he was great because, unfortunately, when I was recording the podcast the first time, I went about 20 minutes before realizing I hadn't recorded a single thing. So we actually went back and we started over. He was a great, great guest, and I was glad to have him. And then there's been other great podcasts. Yeah, I have a whole list. It sounds like you listen to even more podcasts than I do, which is a rarity. But the ultrasound podcast, I think, is huge. If you don't know anything about ultrasound, they're great to listen to. Matt and Mike are some great people who really know what they're doing with the ultrasound probe.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, let's just touch base real quick on the student aspect of this. As you know, the EM Clerkship podcast is predominantly geared towards medical students and interns and some residents and people doing that on their rotations for various reasons. But, you know, being that you have so much interaction with students, what are some of the things that, you know, you could maybe bestow some pearls of wisdom for a student coming in, let's say like a medical student coming in for an emergency room and an ED rotation?
Yeah, so a lot of my stuff is a lot of the basics, but one of the big things that drives me nuts, and usually I stay so interactive with the students, I don't let them get to this point, but I can always pick up when the student really is interested or not. I don't care if emergency medicine is the thing you actually want to do or not. Emergency medicine really can benefit just about everyone, because emergency medicine, I think, and a lot of people talk about it like this, it's the most interesting first 15 minutes of any specialty. You really have to kind of know how to handle the emergencies. Now, that doesn't mean that every patient has an emergent condition. In fact, as we were just kind of talking about earlier, not every patient is emergent. A lot of them are here kind of almost filling up our ED unnecessarily. But what I do see, though, is that you really have to stay involved, because this really is a great rotation to learn a lot, see a lot, kind of learn the basics of management. So be excited. Get involved. You know, don't just sit back. This is not the time to read your textbook. You're bored out of your mind. You know, a good educator should help teach you. And at that same time, make sure to ask questions, kind of get feedback, try and learn the procedures, especially all the procedures that we do in emergency medicine. There's so many of them every single day I'm doing procedures. Now, it's not always intubation, but I may be doing suturing every day, or I may be doing an IND or something else, but there's always something that you're going to end up doing in that department. Dental blocks, I'd even call a procedure, and I do that rather frequently too. Not just because, oh, my tooth hurts, but like lip lacerations or tongue lacerations, dental blocks are amazing for that. So all those skills are things that you need to learn, because you never know when you may need them. And so get involved in the procedures and learn the procedures ahead of time. Don't count on the person who's in the middle of their busy shift. Try and stop and explain all the basics and get to that. Try and learn as much of that ahead of time as possible. In a sense, it's like flipping the classroom. You know, learn the stuff in advance. Now, don't be cocky about it, but learn the stuff in advance. And that way you can have a somewhat informed and good discussion when you talk about, hey, I saw you did it this way. Maybe it's something different than the actual way you listened to a podcast or read a textbook or whatever that said, this is how we do it, and see what the difference is. Sometimes, actually often, I feel like my practice changes with time, because I find new, better research, or I realize that maybe this research really doesn't work for me because I'm in a different setting. Whatever the reason is, I really take that into account. And so there's a lot of stuff that changes over time. And I think that's one of the big things is sometimes, even if a podcast is only a year old, practice may have already changed. A great example of that is how we manage sepsis. Go back to, and I feel like I keep plugging him, but go back to MCRIT very early on about early goal-directed therapy in sepsis. We don't really do it that way anymore. But the podcast is only a few years old. And if you listen to how it progresses with time, you actually see just how much it changes. And I think that's so important to keep in mind when you're doing these rotations. Those textbooks are usually even old. So the textbooks are a great base, don't get me wrong. But just keep in mind, practice does change rapidly, especially in the emergency medicine setting.
So Chip, you know, you're a PA. Give me your take on the industry now and any upcoming changes, some of the stuff that's on the forefront of the minds of PAs right now.
Sure. Actually, PAs are changing quite a bit recently. There's a couple of things that are maybe somewhat more minor or more technical changes, but then there's the big overarching, you know, big progression that we're trying to make going on. A few of the smaller details, physician assistant, it's so confusing, and the actual term is that a lot of people, you know, there's not many things that's a terminal degree that's called assistant, right? You know, that's not a good kind of word. Maybe associate would be better or something else. That's a huge debate in the PA world right now. But a lot of people have agreed we'll just call ourselves PAs. We'll try not to mention the assistant as much because it is so confusing. One other thing is we often get paired up with nurse practitioners. The traditional term has been mid-level. And if you talk to a lot of them now, we try and avoid the term mid-level. It gets confusing because, okay, then what's higher or lower level? You know, is the doc higher level? Then what are you going to call the lower level provider? No one really wants to be called that. So we're moving away from that. We're calling it advanced practice provider. That seems to be the most kosher term at the time. But again, that's rapidly changing too as we come up with better terms. So we got little technical things that are going on like that. But really the PA profession now versus when it started about 50 years ago, because we're about at the 50-year anniversary, very, very different. What we do nowadays is actually a lot of, I don't want to say independent or autonomous, but there's a lot of things we do on our own. It used to be that you'd have to run through every patient, have every chart co-signed, not be able to provide any prescriptions yourself. You had to have the doc you're with do it. Now, there's some places that are the same way to that degree somewhat, but really it's not like that as it used to be. And a lot of that is thanks to good laws that are changing. A lot of the docs that I work with, both younger and older, recognize that physicians cannot be the only ones to take care of patients. You know, we have a doctor shortage, just like we have a nursing shortage and everything else. So we can't rely on only physicians being the only ones to actually see, diagnose, and treat patients. It is so much more than that, that really we do have to count on the other counterparts, whether those are nurse practitioners, PAs, you know, there's even like the community paramedic that is starting up, and we'll see how that goes as far as what they are able to do versus not. I know some places talking about prescriptions and those types of things. But a lot of that, to me, the PA is really the growing role where in some ways, in the U.S. especially, because so much of our healthcare is tied to the dollar, that this may be a good place for us to grow and try and do things that maybe are not as financially rewarding for a physician to do, or it may have such narrow cost margins that maybe physicians aren't going to be the only ones who do it. One thing I think is needing to desperately change, and one thing I'm trying to work on is to get the pre-hospital world, more PAs, nurse practitioners, and physicians in general, but I think PAs have a really solid role, especially the ones with the fire EMS type background, which there are quite a few of, because nurse practitioners are traditionally nurses first, they're RNs, and they then increase their level of training by going to nurse practitioner school, whereas most of the time PAs tend to be more of a military background. Some of them are nurses, but a lot of them tend to go to the nurse practitioner route, or they have their fire EMS background or some other unique background that isn't just the traditional, you know, you were a nurse first or you were a tech first of some kind. You know, it just varies. And I really think all those unique experiences, including like physical therapy, respiratory therapy, you know, we have students from those fields and backgrounds as well. I think all those unique backgrounds are really helping PAs to strive in their specialties and subspecialties. And we've really kind of, in a sense, dominated what we want to be and what we want to become. And so I really think over the next 5-10 years, the PA profession is going to change that much more that listening to this podcast in another 5 or 10 years is going to say, wait, we don't even do any of that anymore.
Yeah, so, you know, just in this, in the spirit of being devil's advocate, let me challenge you on this thing. You know, there are a lot of physicians and a lot of other practitioners that say, hey, you know, you guys focus a lot on this whole title thing. Is it really that important what you're called? And, you know, why does that matter? I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I'm the physician and you're not. So that makes sense to me. Well, how come it doesn't, you know, why is it a problem?
So I think it's a couple of issues. It's kind of hard to answer, especially in a short podcast, but to keep it brief, to keep it straightforward, a little bit of it is to deal with stigma, because that, again, that assistant part of the name makes it sound like, well, you're just my helper. Like, you know, it's like the medical assistant. Medical assistant doesn't see, diagnose, or treat anyone on its own. And a lot of patients, when they hear that assistant term, they automatically jump to medical assistant, or they call it, you know, doctor's assistant. That's one of the ones I find my favorite, just because, like, that's not at all what I said. But that name gets so confusing there that the main reason why I think the name change needs to happen is because even with all the educational resources that the PA profession has set out, patients are still confused by it. And in turn, some doctors are confused by it too. They don't understand. They see that physician assistant title, and some PAs are actually being used as scribes where they're working at. They're not even being used their full potential, which is both harmful to the PA because they're losing their skill set, and it's really not benefiting the doctor because usually they're paying for a very expensive scribe versus someone who is actually, you know, trained and knowledgeable in a certain background. So for me, I think it pays off in a lot of different ways. Just something as simple as a name change may help kind of clarify and help better define what our role is. And like I said, this can go into so much more detail, but just in a nutshell, I think the two big things that would benefit is better outlining our role and better helping patients understand this is what we are, this is what we aren't.
So you mentioned a couple of the bigger changes that are coming up in the PA world. What were some of those?
So some of the big changes that we're trying to do is to make one thing, and this is a huge debate right now. We're going to see how this folds out over the next few months, maybe even take the next couple of years, honestly, is how we recertify and relicense as a PA. Currently, it is a 10-year test cycle. Now, some of us are still in the 6-year test cycle. Luckily, I was one of the first ones in the 10-year test cycle, so I at least get to wait 10 years before we figure out how we take my test again or what kind of test I do. But the test cycle is a big deal because the test, as it stands right now, called the PANRE, the Physician Assistant National Recertification Exam, is all about general medicine. And so for me as a PA in emergency medicine, it may not be as big a deal, but then again, I can't tell you the standard statin therapy off the top of my head or all different types of conditions and research. So that's not what I do on a regular daily basis. So that's a potential question that I may run across that I don't know the answer. But give me hey, look at this chest x-ray, tell me these labs and tell me what's going on. That's something a little more up my alley. And the problem is you get these people who are so specialized, say in dermatology. Again, we can speak on dermatology again here, but truly, dermatology is very different than most primary care because it really isn't primary care, it's a specialty. Or someone who does cardiothoracic surgery. Again, they're not going to know a lot of these primary care type questions. And so there's a big debate about should we keep doing that recertification model or should we change? Another big thing that's going on in the PA world is we're trying to standardize PAs in their states. So some states are great for PAs. So the American Academy of Physician Assistants, AAPA, is really pushing this change that we need to standardize our state laws because in some states, they're great to practice in. Missouri really isn't that great. And that's one of my big frustrations with Missouri is we're just way behind on the times with what we can do. We technically do not have full prescriptive authority because we can't prescribe all controlled substances. And that's a very common one across the state. Others are about the collaboration requirements. You know, do we require that we have so many co-signatures? Or do we also have to have a certain physician PA or NP ratio? So AAPA looks into that and can say, out of our 6 core measures, which ones do we believe you have fulfilled? And some states are 6 out of 6, so that's pretty rare. Most of them are, you know, 3 or 4 out of 6. I think Missouri is currently 2 out of 6, but it depends on how you look at some of the way the laws are written. But that's one of the big things that AAPA is pushing. Let's get every state to have all these core measures that PAs are practicing to the full potential they trained. But I think those are kind of the two big things right now. getting us all standardized and getting our testing figured out, because really the recertification process is how we lose some really great PAs. Again, you may be an awesome CT surgery PA, or you may be great in critical care, but you may not necessarily pass your pannery in 6 to 10 years, because a lot of those questions are things you're not doing on a daily basis. And that's kind of a shame, is we're one of the few professions that really does that. Nurse practitioners, from my understanding, aren't really having that standard test that they have to take every 6 or 10 years or whatever. And physicians, they may have to reboard every 10 years, like an internal medicine, but they actually don't have to specifically take, a general physician exam. They're taking it in internal medicine, what they're practicing in. So I think that's a big difference that's hindering us in some ways.
Hey, Chip, I know you mentioned earlier in the podcast the Total EM website that you run and the podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how people can get in touch with you, connect with you on social media?
Sure. So first off, before I forget, my email for the podcast and everything is thetotalem@gmail.com. That's thetotalem@gmail.com. And that's the email address. If you want to ask me anything directly, it's the best way to get a hold of me. Now, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. My personal profile for LinkedIn, although I don't really use it that much. But Twitter and Facebook are the main places to find me, that to ask me stuff or talk about, or kind of see what I'm posting, what's staying updated. I do have a website called totalem.org. That's without the V, so it's just totalem.org. And that website has all the stuff that I'm currently working on. So I have a podcast, and that podcast is available on iTunes. You can also go directly to the website to see it. But it's all about emergency medicine. And TOTAL stands for Tools of the Trade in Academic Learning. So it's all about, the best evidence that we have out there. It's also talking about specific people and their resources they have or whatnot. So I do a lot of interviews with, say, like Min LeCong or Jim DeCanto or any number of other people about this is what they do, this is what they have. And then I've been doing some other kind of subspecialty related type of things, such as pre-hospital care. One of the big ones that I've done that's been very popular has been EMS to ED handoffs and ED to EMS handoffs. And those are some really recent podcasts. I think they were numbers 16 and 17. So overall, it has a couple of different things, but the main things are we want to work with people who are already somewhat, have some background in training. But I mean, you can listen to some of these as a medical student and it makes sense. But we're really trying to hit on the professionals who are in emergency medicine or in related fields, and we're going over some of the key topics that are in those settings. And we like to focus on some of the rural emergency medicine side. We're growing that aspect a little bit by having some other people who will hopefully be coming on soon and acting as maybe co-hosts or just regular guests of the show. And we believe that rural emergency medicine is very underrepresented because, like I said, a lot of these podcasts you listen to, they're talking about the urban ED setting. Well, most of us don't practice in an urban ED tertiary care. Most of us are practicing in the rural setting. So we really want to plug and kind of get these people the knowledge they need so they can be good at their jobs. Because, again, the specialists are going to be at your hospital. And if they are, like we have sometimes interventional cardiology and sometimes not, well, what if they're not there the day that you need them? So knowing those basic skills, knowing that management style is very, very important. You want to hit on that really hard. We also have two other sides of the website because that's all the emergency professional side. We do have a growing part that I'm focusing on, which is about the public. So we have an upcoming anaphylaxis lecture, and that anaphylaxis podcast is going to be set up both for, kind of the basics of anaphylaxis and its management, as well as getting patients that understanding so they can kind of look and say, okay, this is what it means to have anaphylaxis. This is why you use an EpiPen. This is why it's so important after you use an EpiPen to go to the ED. you know, all those types of things. And then the third part is what we call our friends, and that's podcasts that we routinely listen to or blog sites we go to that, you know, they're highly recommended. And these are ones that if you like ours, you should go to them because they do similar stuff. The Total EM is a big project there that we try and get all that stuff.
That sounds great, man. So you mentioned the EM Crit podcast. You mentioned the Ultrasound podcast. Can you give us just a little snapshot of some of your other favorites?
Sure. Like I said, EM Crit, the Ultrasound podcast, they were two of my first ones I really listened to. ER Cast is kind of funny just because he brings up some very relevant topics. The same that he's kind of gone on to MRAP and isn't doing that as much, but it's a really good one. You know, I have to admit, I started listening to EM Clerkship. I now have listened to all of them before we got to talk today.
Thank you.
Really enjoy it. It's nice and quick and short, and really like your tidbit on there when you go on and do kind of your 30-second spiel. I think that's a very clever way to help introduce cases. So I've really enjoyed that. Can't go without mentioning some PA podcasts. The Physician Assistant Exam Review is one of the two resources I use to get through my boards the first time. And the Pain Podcast is a new one that I've started listening to. And that's with Chris Madej. He does a really, really excellent job going over some very key aspects. Again, he aims more for students, just like the EM Clerkship does. But I think sometimes you just got to go back to the basics and really understand the basics first. SMAC is my go-to when I need something inspirational because they have so many good inspirational talks. So I usually have been listening to one of those about every car trip I drive because my car trip right now is about 2 hours round trip. So I get to listen to a lot of podcasts. And really, SMAC has been a good one for inspiration for me. If I just need to get that little motivation before I go in to shift, that yes, this is what I'm doing, this is why I'm doing it. So just all those different types of podcasts I listen to. And like I said above, for the friends stuff, or the our friends stuff is something I'm working on more because I want people to get those good resources out there.
Yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned that. For if you're a medical student or intern or resident that's been living under a rock somewhere and you have no idea what we're talking about, get yourself an iPhone or an iTunes account and log on, search under podcasts for emergency medicine, and you will see a host of different shows pop up. Do recommend you kind of take a look at the last time the show was updated. Although there are some great shows that sort of live in perpetuity. Scott Weingart has put all of his older episodes in the EM Crit archives. And so those are still available for a lot of the things that don't change as quickly. And if you mentioned or if you heard us mention SMAC and have no idea what we're talking about, that is the Social Media and Critical Care Conference that happens once a year in a different place. And right now, the next SMAC conference is going to happen in Berlin next June. 8 days, 19 hours, and 17 minutes to the second ticket release for Das SMAC, which will happen in Berlin next year. Some great talks. And they do, as Ollie Flower would say, they do it for the love. So they post all the talks online so you can see. If you've never been on it, do go on it. I'm a huge fan of Foam and Foam podcasts, so I'm a big fan of I think my first, I got to give a shout out to Steve Carroll, who was the host of the EM Basic podcast. Yeah, EM Basic. That was probably the first emergency medicine podcast that I really got into. And then love the folks over at Foamcast. Do a great podcast, real fast moving and lively. Lauren Westerfer's on that program. She's really awesome.
Jeremy Faust, I believe.
Yeah. The as he would say, yeah, the lesser
known going on.
Right, exactly. Great accent to listen to if you want to get your accent fixed for the day. And so there's a lot of really good things going on, and you should tap in. Definitely for reference, big favorite is probably the Life in the Fast Lane website.
And that actually reminds me, too, if you are not very good with pediatrics, there are two really good ones. The PIMED podcast, which unfortunately is also in a slight coma right now, but there is the Pediatric Emergency Medicine Playbook, and that is really, really well done. And I would highly recommend, if you're looking at emergency medicine or just pediatrics in general, just so well done, the pacing, that I'd highly recommend listening to it as well.
That's excellent, man.
So see, you got me on a roll, and now I'm not going to stop.
Great sources. I know, it's really hard. And don't feel bad if you don't catch any of this stuff. We're going to put as much as much of it as we can into the show notes and make sure that you guys can have links. But really, I mean, it takes, about, 30 minutes to get into the deep end of the pool here, and you will find resources just at every turn. Some really, really great stuff out there. Chip Lang is a physician assistant in rural Missouri, and thanks for joining us on the EM Clerkship podcast, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show for today. Please tell a friend about the podcast. Leave us a review on iTunes. Be sure to follow Zach and I on Twitter. You can follow me using the Twitter handle at EMClerkship and the number 2. And you can follow Zach at EMClerkship. And you can follow today's guest, Chip Lang, at the_total_EM. Until next time, keep working hard, keep studying, and be sure to enjoy your shift.